From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. NATO worries mount over eastern Ukraine and Russian militarization of Crimea. Protests continue in Ferguson, Missouri. U.S. plays role in Yemeni hostage rescue. Ebola death toll climbs. We'll take an unusual look at the meaning of gratitude. These and other stories coming up. I'm Ray Kugel. The top U.S. general in Europe says he is alarmed at Russia's actions in Crimea and provocative military flights in NATO airspace. Jamie Detmer reports from Kiev.
General Philip Breedlove, head of the U.S. European Command and NATO Supreme Allied Commander, told reporters here in Kiev after meetings with Ukrainian leaders that he's alarmed at the Russian militarization of the Black Sea Peninsula of Crimea, which Moscow annexed from Ukraine in March.
We are very concerned with the militarization of Crimea. We're concerned that the capabilities in Crimea that are being installed will bring effect to almost the entire Black Sea.
The general said the military build-up by Moscow includes cruise and surface-to-air missiles able to exert, as he put it, military influence on the region. Breedlove also voiced worry about the nature of provocative Russian military flights being flown over NATO countries, although he stressed the flights are in international airspace.
The number and the pattern has changed, maybe as much as three times as much as we have seen before. Also, we see that some of these flights have increased in size, normally before seeing only one or two airplanes and now seeing groups of airplanes.
Last month, NATO reported an unusual spike in Russian military flights over the Black, Baltic and North Seas and the Atlantic Ocean. Several European governments, including Britain's, say they have scrambled jets in response to what NATO spokesmen describe as large-scale manoeuvres. And they claim the Russian warplanes frequently fly with their transponders switched off, making them a potential hazard for commercial aircraft. According to NATO officials, alliance pilots have conducted over 100 intercepts of Russian aircraft this year, about three times more than in 2013, an interception rate reminiscent of the Cold War. Tensions have been running high between NATO and Russia since Moscow began backing an insurgency by pro-Kremlin militants in eastern Ukraine. Breedlove, four times, shied away from revealing whether he thinks the Obama administration should supply Ukraine with arms and other lethal weaponry, as requested by Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko.
We continue to look at the requirements here in Ukraine. We continue to advise and offer our thoughts on these, and nothing at this time is off the table.
So far, the U.S. has restricted a $118 million military aid package to non-lethal items, such as body armor and night vision devices, although it is delivering three portable anti-mortar radar systems. The Kremlin, which denies it is fomenting the insurgency in the east, or that Russian soldiers and armor have crossed the border, has warned that any arming of Ukraine by the U.S. will be seen as a provocation. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kiev.
Protesters took to the streets for a third day Wednesday in Ferguson, Missouri, following Monday's grand jury decision not to indict a white police officer in the death of a black teenager who assaulted him. Hundreds of people demonstrated in front of the St. Louis City Hall on Wednesday. Police arrested three people. The August non-shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown by Officer Darren Wilson inflamed tensions in Ferguson and raised concerns about police violence and racial discrimination in the mostly black St. Louis suburb. The more than 2,000 National Guard soldiers deployed in Ferguson appear to have kept down the violence that ravaged the city a day earlier. Other cities across the nation, including New York, Boston, Los Angeles, Portland, Oregon, and Dallas, were quiet after largely peaceful demonstrations. Hong Kong authorities have deployed thousands of police in the city's Mong Kok district to try to prevent pro-democracy activists from reoccupying a protest camp dismantled by the government. Police and other government personnel completed a two-day removal of the Occupy Mong Kok protest site Wednesday. Some protesters refused to leave and scuffled with police, who responded with batons and pepper spray and arrested about 150 people. Dozens of activists returned to the streets Wednesday night and tried to renew the sit-in, but police forcibly removed them by this morning. The activists are demanding that the Hong Kong and mainland Chinese governments allow voters to have a genuine choice of candidates for the city's next leadership election in 2017. The United States military says it did play a role in a Yemeni raid that freed eight hostages held by al-Qaeda in a remote part of the country. VOA's Jeff Seldon has details.
A day after the Pentagon refused to comment, a defense official tells VOA the U.S. military supported and cooperated with Yemeni forces in an operation that freed Yemeni hostages and an Ethiopian. Yemeni officials said earlier the raid in a part of the country's east known as an al-Qaeda safe haven also killed seven suspected al-Qaeda fighters. Northeastern University terrorism expert Professor Max Abrams says with or without U.S. involvement, the operation's noteworthy.
It worked in two senses. The first is there was the release of hostages, and several of the hostage takers were killed.
As first reported by the New York Times, some two dozen American commandos took part in the operation. Abrams says the apparent success may put more pressure on the U.S. to turn to special forces in its fight against terrorists elsewhere.
We don't have alternative options on the ground, either in Syria or in Iraq. The moderate Syrian rebels are in complete disarray. We can't rely on them there. And in Iraq, the reality is that the government and the military forces there are taking a longer time to train as well.
But Brian Michael Jenkins, a senior advisor at the RAND Corporation and a former Green Beret, says while the use of special forces in rescue missions has happened several times over the past few years, no one should expect it to become the norm.
These are high-risk missions. They require very precise intelligence. It requires an opportunity, a true opportunity to rescue the hostage. And as we've seen, in many cases, it simply doesn't work.
President Barack Obama has pointed to Washington's counterterrorism efforts with Yemen, which put Yemeni forces on the front lines, as a successful example of his administration's strategy. But defense officials caution the decision to cooperate with Yemeni forces in this hostage rescue mission was made only after consultations with Yemen's president. Jeff Seldon, VOA News, Washington.
Activists say the death toll from Syrian airstrikes on the Islamic State group's main city of Raqqa rose to at least 95 people. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the dead included at least 52 civilians. It did not specify how many militants, if any, were killed. Gunmen opened fire on a polio vaccination team in southwestern Pakistan Wednesday, killing at least four people and wounding several others. Police say that three female health workers are among the dead. The incident occurred in Quetta, the capital of Balochistan province. South Asia leaders are meeting in Nepal for a summit seeking closer regional cooperation. Anjana Pasricha reports.
The vision spelled out by leaders of eight countries that make up the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation in Kathmandu on Wednesday had a common thread, the need to combat poverty and terrorism by working more closely with each other. Saying that the reaction to SAARC is usually cynicism and skepticism, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi stressed the need to deepen integration in South Asia.
For India, our vision for the region rests on five pillars: trade, investment, assistance, cooperation in every area, contacts between our people, and all through seamless connectivity. This is the call of our times.
He promised that India would take the lead by stepping up facilities at borders, making it easier to get business visas and simplifying procedures. South Asian countries conduct a meager 5% of their total trade with each other. But with no progress by India and Pakistan in breaking the ice between them, critics questioned how South Asia can become more integrated. Hopes that the SAARC meeting in Nepal would set the stage for a thaw between the region's two countries have failed to materialize so far. The Indian Prime Minister was to meet heads of all countries on the sidelines of the summit, barring his Pakistani counterpart. In what many observers saw as an oblique reference to India, Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif stressed the need for trust.
My vision for our region is a dispute-free South Asia, where instead of fighting each other, we jointly fight poverty, illiteracy, disease, malnourishment, and unemployment. We invest in our youth to unleash their creativity, talent, and enterprise. We need our bonds of trust so that we can solve our problems.
However, each side appears to have put the onus on the other to build trust. The Pakistani Prime Minister indicated that the ball is now in India's court to restart talks, while New Delhi said it was only interested in a meaningful dialogue. Their ties have been in a deep freeze since New Delhi called off talks with Islamabad in August. The worst cross-border violence in a decade in Kashmir has soured relations further. The difficulties of SAARC making progress are apparent. There was no consensus on three key pacts to integrate energy grids and free up rail and road movement. Indian officials said that Pakistan had indicated it needed more time. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
The Saudi Arabian oil minister says a key grouping of Gulf oil producers reached a consensus on oil production targets and will take a unified position when OPEC oil ministers meet today in Vienna. The OPEC meeting is widely seen as one of the most crucial in years, with oil prices falling more than 30% since June to a four-year low of below $78 a barrel. The official death toll from the Ebola outbreak in West Africa is now 5,689. The latest figures from the World Health Organization comes amid signs the spread of the virus is slowing but has not stopped. The UN agency says the number of newly reported cases is stable in Guinea and stable or declining in Liberia, but may still be increasing in Sierra Leone, which accounts for two-thirds of all new cases. With a global AIDS epidemic well into its fourth decade, organizations in Africa and elsewhere say they're worried that the Ebola virus is taking the spotlight off the far deadlier scourge of HIV and its associated ailments. One South African AIDS campaign is just days left before expiring. VOA's Anita Powell has more from Johannesburg.
As the Ebola virus takes more lives in West Africa and dominates headlines, Sipongile Shabalala knows the treatment action campaign has run out of steam at the worst possible time. The South African AIDS advocacy group is facing imminent shutdown over a budget shortfall of about 10 million rand, about $900,000. Shabalala is the group's chairwoman for the province of Gauteng. She spoke to VOA News in Johannesburg, Gauteng's capital. Shabalala agrees that Ebola is a major problem and is worthy of attention. But she says, so is AIDS.
Ebola is a crisis that everyone must deal with. However, with the HIV funding, is the picture that our government is painting outside, in outside countries. Funders feel that HIV is no longer a sexy a disease that they can fund. However, we still have a lot of people who are dying because of AIDS-related diseases. Almost over 700 people are dying a day, of which it's too much for us to have those people who are dying every day in South Africa. That tells us that there's much lot more work to be done on HIV, and that tells us that we haven't won the fight against HIV yet.
The group now has until World AIDS Day, December 1st, to raise that money, and despite some generous pledges, is still far from that goal. Their financial crash was caused by the pullout of major foreign government sponsors, who now deem South Africa to be a middle-income nation, and therefore no longer in need. South Africa also has the world's largest AIDS medication program. Ebola is a swift killer. Many patients die in days or weeks, and in horrible pain, and there is no cure. Medical advancements mean that AIDS can now be a lifelong condition instead of a death sentence. But that doesn't make AIDS any less dangerous. If Ebola maintains the pace it started at the beginning of this year, as documented by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, it may kill about 16 people on December 1st. On World AIDS Day, AIDS may kill as many as 4,400. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
According to a new poll, Americans are split on whether President Obama was right to take executive action to protect millions of illegal immigrants from deportation. Quinnipiac University found 48% of those surveyed opposed the president's action on immigration last week, while 45% support it. Advocates on both sides of the issue say immigration will remain a defining political issue in the final 2 years of the Obama presidency. Here's VOA's Jim Malone.
The United States has long considered itself a nation of immigrants, something that President Obama likes to point out as he defends his decision to go it alone on immigration reform.
It's not what we look like. It's not what our last name is. It's not where we come from. It's not how we pray. What makes us American is a shared commitment to an ideal that all of us are created equal. All of us have a chance to make our lives what we will.
Mr. Obama's decision angered many Republicans who regard the action as a blanket amnesty for millions who came into the U.S. illegally. The Republican Speaker of the House, Congressman John Boehner, says there will be a response in time, but he remains vague as to exactly what it will be.
The president has taken actions that he himself has said are those of a king or an emperor, not an American president. And he's doing this at a time when Americans want nothing more than both parties to focus on solving the biggest problems in our country, starting with our still struggling economy.
Coming just weeks after Republican gains in midterm congressional elections, the president had little to lose politically, says American University political scholar James Thurber.
He obviously is thinking, well, they haven't done anything, the Republicans. They probably won't do anything. I'm going to get criticized for this anyway, but I want to do the right thing. It'll be part of my legacy. I'm going to go ahead and do this.
But in the short term, the political price could be costly. Republicans will control both chambers of Congress next year, and their leaders have warned that the president's unilateral action poisons the well for future cooperation. Republicans could go to federal court to try to stop the president's executive action, but that would likely be an uphill legal battle, says Thomas Mann of the Brookings Institution.
It's not easy for Republicans in Congress to either take action that would deny him the ability to implement his own executive order, or to take to the courts, because the courts have largely upheld this kind of discretionary authority by presidents.
No matter what they do, Republican pollster Whit Ayer says his party needs to be careful not to offend Hispanic voters, who are a growing constituency in U.S. presidential elections, beginning with the next one in 2016.
We got a third of the Hispanic vote. We've got to do better with Hispanics, with Asians. You've seen that coming. It's not arguable. And it's simply the challenge that we have to meet successfully if we will ever elect another president.
The Quinnipiac poll also shows President Obama's approval rating at only 39%, a troubling omen for Democrats as Republicans prepare to take over both chambers of Congress in early January. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Today is Thanksgiving Day in America. It is a time for family and friends to gather for a traditional feast of roast turkey with all the trimmings. But as its name implies, Thanksgiving is also a chance for Americans to reflect on the gifts and blessings in their lives and to express gratitude for them. VOA's Adam Phillips took to the streets to ask some of his fellow New Yorkers what they are grateful for and what they think gratitude is.
At a cafe on Manhattan's Upper West Side, just days before Thanksgiving, a young woman named Sue says she's grateful for New York.
I was in Boston for the last 8 years, and I just moved back this September, and I am loving it, being with my family and meeting new friends, so I'm having a great time in New York. Today, it's 70 degrees, middle of November, and have great coffee. That's great.
Meanwhile, Christopher, a newspaper editor, muses about what gratitude is.
It means to be thankful and to realize that the good that you have in the world doesn't come from you, but it is given to you. Every breath I take is a miracle. I didn't provide it. God gives that to me. And so the fact that I'm alive, I'm grateful for. And if you begin there, you realize that you really have to be grateful for everything that you have. I'm grateful that I live in a country that is not at war here, that there are not bombs going off where I live, that I live in a place that is warm in this cold season, that I have enough to eat. Those are good starts.
Jonah, a Columbia University graduate student, also feels thankful.
Feeling it and expressing it lead to, at least for me, very different reactions on my part. I think it actually, in some sense, takes courage to express real gratitude to somebody. I mean, we say thank you to people all the time, that we're grateful for this and for that, but it almost requires opening yourself up and being a little vulnerable to really express a full, deep gratitude about something.
A young mother named Alexandra feels gratitude for her family and friends.
I guess it's a combination of happiness and peace, being content with what you have, being aware maybe, noticing, thinking about it. You can just be grateful, I think, to no one in particular, to good fortune. I don't know if that counts as someone, but I mean, I certainly don't believe in a God or anything like that. I'm not thanking a God. I'm just thankful for, you know, for a good life, thankful for the random luck of a good life.
Ben has a more political take on the season. He says he's grateful to anyone that enhances one's possibility for a better life, and that's why he's grateful for President Barack Obama.
It's a wonder to have a person who has a sense of possibility when it comes to politics, and yet is not defined by his determination to manipulate people. It's a very strange capacity to, on the one hand, have capacity to imagine the world larger than just sort of using people, and yet at the same time understand what you need to do to get things done. I have an African-American son, so that might have some partly to do with it. It's just grace. It makes my kid feel like he's, you know, part of America.
Whether it's because a world figure looks like you or because the apple pie is still warm, gratitude for our many gifts is what makes Thanksgiving a day of the spirit as well as the stomach for Americans worldwide. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated 1/4 of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. 2/3 of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page. Find out more by visiting us at our webpage at voanews.com and then click on Digital Frontier. Tell your story and share it with the world through VOA's Digital Frontier.
President Obama issued a traditional pardon to one of two Thanksgiving turkeys Wednesday, sparing it from the dinner table and granting it the chance to live out its days in a Northern Virginia turkey farm. In a White House appearance, also attended by his two daughters Wednesday, Mr. Obama granted the pardon to a turkey named Cheese, a rotund white bird with a rosy-colored head and neck. The move came on the eve of the annual Thanksgiving holiday. And that's it for this edition of International Edition. Thank you for joining us. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
This is Today in History. On November 27, 1095, Pope Urban II launched the First Crusade by appealing for a Christian army to defeat the Turks and take control of Jerusalem. Despite widespread inexperience and poor discipline, the First Crusade defeated Muslim forces and occupied the city in 1099. On this day in 1701, Swedish astronomer Anders Celsius was born. He's best known for devising the Celsius temperature scale. In 1895, Swedish chemist and explosives maker Alfred Nobel signed his last will and testament, setting aside much of his estate to establish the Nobel Prizes that are still awarded annually. In 1921, Alexander Dubček was born. Becoming the first secretary of the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia in 1968, Dubček presided over the so-called Prague Spring, an effort to liberalize the communist regime. The experiment abruptly ended when Warsaw Pact forces occupied the country. Dubček was expelled from the party and sent into internal exile. On this day in 1954, former U.S. State Department employee Alger Hiss was released from prison after serving 44 months for perjury. Hiss was convicted of lying about his complicity in a scheme to pass secret government documents to the Soviet Union. In 1970, Pope Paul VI was attacked at the Manila airport by a Bolivian painter disguised as a priest. On November 27, 1973, U.S. Congressman Gerald Ford was overwhelmingly confirmed by the Senate to be the first vice president elevated to that position under the 25th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
The first Thursday in November is a national day of Thanksgiving in the United States. The tradition is a very old one, dating to the arrival of the first English settlers in North America in the 17th century, who, after their first successful harvest, paused to celebrate their bounty and give thanks for surviving their first terrible winter in what was then a wilderness. Falling in the autumn, Thanksgiving has much in common with harvest holidays in other nations and cultures, such as Vietnam's Chung Tu celebration and Hamoo, the annual yam festival in Ghana. Still, with its turkey dinners, family gatherings, football games, and parades, there's something about the day that is distinctively American. Together with July 4th, when the United States marks its independence from Great Britain, it's a truly national holiday that includes all citizens in a common purpose, regardless of religious, political, or ethnic persuasion. It is also a time for people to look back at the year, take stock, and think about the future. With our nation dealing with crises in Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and West Africa, the looming uncertainties of 2015 likely will be on many minds today. President Abraham Lincoln proclaimed the first official Thanksgiving amid similar serious circumstances, the American Civil War. But like their colonial ancestors, Americans are essentially an optimistic people. Surrounded by friends and family, today as in the past, they will enter into the spirit of the day, giving thanks for life's blessings and the promise of the future living in a free land.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.